So I want to start with a puzzle. And the puzzle is this. While about half of government aid to the poor takes the form of in-kind transfers of healthcare, education, housing vouchers, food stamps, elder care, disability accommodation, job training programs, and child care, most economists and many political philosophers tend to focus the discussion of inequality on issues of income and wealth. In his 1970 essay, Unlimiting the Domain of Inequality, economist and Nobel laureate James Tobin observed, quote, "While the concerned layman who sees people with shabby housing or too little to eat instinctively wants to provide them with decent housing and adequate food, economists instinctively want to provide them with more cash income. Then they can buy the housing and food that they want to, and if they choose not to, the presumption is that they have a better use for the money." So what I want to ask is, what accounts for this gap between government policy and popular opinion on the one side and the recommendations from economists and many political philosophers on the other side? As Tobin notes, most economists tend to think that providing benefits in kind is inefficient, right? People have a better use for their resources, and so you're preventing them from using the resources in the optimal way to satisfy their preferences. Philosophers tend to oppose in-kind provision as paternalistic. They argue that it's insulting to interfere with a person's choices within her legitimate sphere of authority, even for the reason of advancing that person's own good, and that much in-kind distribution represents just such an intervention. Although he doesn't say so explicitly in his essay, Tobin's own discussion, in which he endorses some in-kind distribution, suggests that the main reason to do so is paternalism. So how compelling are the efficiency and paternalist objections to in-kind distribution? So the first part of my talk, I want to do something negative. I want to simply clear room for a positive argument for in-kind distribution. And so this will be a shorter part. I just want to show that the efficiency and the paternalism charges can be met. So they're not decisive, and that in many, many cases, we have answers to them. And then the second part of the talk, I'm going to present a justification, which I hope is somewhat new, for in-kind provision. And I'm going to argue in particular that the provision of certain in-kind goods is necessary for what I call the full inclusion of society's members. So I have a full inclusion argument for providing in-kind goods. And a second argument I'm going to make is that in-kind goods promote social solidarity. And that social solidarity, among other things, helps stabilize and reproduce the conditions for full inclusion over time. So these two arguments, the full inclusion and the solidarity arguments, are going to give, I hope, a reason to really push hard on the importance of in-kind distribution. And then in the final section of the talk, I'll try to respond to some objections. So before I proceed, two quick caveats. The first is that there are plausible and many think compelling arguments for a more equal distribution of income and wealth than is currently the case in the United States and most developed countries, actually most developed and undeveloped countries. I've made this argument myself in some of my writings. The case for the distribution of in-kind goods is not meant to override those arguments, but to put them in their proper place. In important cases, I'm going to argue that cash can't substitute for in-kind goods and the particular kind of role we need them to play. In addition, and I'll say something about this at the end of the talk, you might argue, it could be argued, and I would argue, that inequality of income and wealth is of less concern where the state provides certain services such as high quality education and healthcare to all, where employment is guaranteed, and where housing and transportation are subsidized. And so I'll come back to that at the very end. So first caveat, cash is still important. Second caveat, critics of in-kind distribution, including the most relentless efficiency-mongering economists, usually will grant a narrow class of exceptions, political goods and public goods. So think about votes. Votes are things we give as an entitlement to every citizen, even to those citizens who would prefer to have cash instead of a vote. Maybe, as Tobin claimed, and I actually think he's wrong about this, but he's a Nobel laureate in economics and I'm not, but he claimed that any first-year student of economics could show that a market in votes would be Pareto optimal. But even if that were the case, few of us would argue that citizens should be able to sell their votes for cash. Now, I think it's a really interesting question why we all think that, or why most of us think that. And hopefully what I'll say in this talk will give us, help illuminate some of our reasons for that. So economists usually will not advocate for buying and selling votes or allowing people to trade their votes. National defense is an example of a public good, where economists will argue that such goods, because they're non-rivalrous and they're non-excludable, they'll be underprovided if you try to get people to pay cash in order to be protected. And so governments distribute these goods in kind directly. So if we leave aside a narrow class of political goods and pure public goods, why should a government distribute resources in kind rather than in cash? Now, most economists will say that in the vast majority of cases, cash is just superior on efficiency grounds to in-kind goods. This has been referred to by the economist Huey Reinhardt as the key idea in Economics 100, or sometimes we would think of it as Economics 101, right? Anybody who goes through Economics 101 knows that cash is more efficient than giving goods in kind, putting a restriction on what people can do with their resources. And then at least some of the enthusiasm for a basic income stems from a rejection of in-kind good provision, where people will argue that such provision has been objectionably paternalist and insulting to people, and we should treat people as adults and simply give them cash that they can then make their own choices as to how to spend their money rather than making those choices for them. To give you an example from Philippe Van Parys, he actually argues that we can only justify the in-kind provision of healthcare to the extent that we think a reasonable person would have insured against particular ailments, or in cases of externalities, such as those of communicable disease. But you should note this would fall far short of the healthcare that most governments in developed countries, excepting the US, give in kind as a right to their own citizens. If you look at development economics till very recently, the presumption in development economics was that cash was superior in almost all cases to in-kind good distribution. Now, as economics has taken a more experimental turn, there's more evidence being accumulated about what works and doesn't work. But basically, it is still the case, I think, in economics and to a large extent in philosophy, that we ought to be thinking about distribution in cash terms and not in kind. This given that people currently take can be contrasted with an older tradition of thought. According to that tradition, which includes socialists like R.H. Tawney and early proponents of the welfare state like T.H. Marshall, the provision of some goods is so fundamental to our equal standing as citizens that those goods should be distributed in kind by government to everybody, more or less equally, even in the absence of market failures, and even when the narrow class of political goods are not at stake. And so my positive aim in the talk is to develop that line of thought further. So let me start with the negative, and I can go through these somewhat fast. So as I said, the efficiency argument against in-kind distribution is pretty straightforward, assuming people are well-informed and rational, that there are no natural monopolies, externalities, or other forms of market failure. If you allow people to trade their assets, give them cash, they're going to trade until they reach an equilibrium when nobody can be made better off without somebody else being made worse off. And of course, the qualifications are important. People often lack critical information and can be manipulated to juice goods that have little actual value for them. Some trades have effects on third parties that aren't accounted for in the price of goods. I refer to these elsewhere under the heading of weak agency. And weak agency types of considerations give rise to three justifications for in-kind provision. So three cases where in-kind provision will be efficient. So the first has to do with in-household distribution, and this actually relates to developing countries. So maybe there is such a person as Homo economicus, but even if there is, there is no infans economicus, right? Making decisions and using resources. In-kind provision given to male heads of households in the context of development has been found, right, to lead to less resources for women and children than when those goods are given either to the women themselves or in kind, right, in the form of education and food. So one reason to think about in-kind distribution is because of the weak agency of some of the parties in a who are recipients of the aid. In a recent study of Indian households looking at preferences over for cash versus food, the economist Retika Kara found that poor women overwhelmingly preferred that they get food and not cash, and that's simply because the husbands or men in the family took the cash and spent it on things like alcohol and cigarettes. So that's one reason. Second reason is, again, another form of market failure, externalities. Economists justify providing in-kind goods like education to all children because they argue there are third-party effects of an uneducated citizenry that individual decision makers might not be taking into account when they're making their choices about how much education to give their children. Even in cases where there is awareness of the externality costs, there can be coordination problems in getting everybody to coordinate together on a particular outcome. So again, in those cases, providing the good in kind gets you to a better solution than simply giving it as a private good to individuals in the form of cash that they can use or not use. A third justification is more recent. This has to do with the limited knowledge of governments. So if a government wants to target certain kinds of goods, certain kinds of benefits, but doesn't have information about who is eligible for those benefits, perhaps it doesn't have a really good tax accounting system. One of the ways you can target is to have people self-identify, which you can do by offering a good that might be at a level where people with more resources won't have an incentive to take the good, whereas if I offered cash in those circumstances, everybody would have an incentive to take the cash. So, all right, so there are some conditions under which in-kind goods distribution is efficient. That's negative, case one. Okay, but even if you thought, like, big deal, like, efficiency isn't the only value, and there's a more pressing objection to in-kind goods, and that is that in-kind good provision is paternalist. In-kind, as opposed to cash transfers, supplant one person's capacity to decide with another's, let's say with the state's or with some other parties, often on grounds of that first person's welfare. To decide for people, especially on matters that concern only their lives and not others, is to show disrespect for their autonomy. Now note that the anti-paternalist objection doesn't depend on these assumptions being false. We just saw, right, that in the case of the households in India, right, the money was spent on alcohol and not on the children and the wives' needs. But even so, again, you might argue that paternalism is objectionable even when it's, for somebody's own good. Now, the case of the family is it's other people's goods, it's not. But even when it's your own good, when you're likely to be wrong, it's still seen as objectionable. The argument about paternalism isn't that the person isn't wrong, it's that even if they're wrong, they have the right to be wrong in this domain. Now, I share the critics' concern about paternalism, and I'll note that lots of in-kind distribution has been given in an objectionably paternalist way. But I don't think in-kind provision is, by its nature, paternalistic. So that's what I want to look at. Like, is it the case that giving things in kind rather than in cash is, because of that, objectionably paternalist? And what I think is, we can't answer the question of whether it's paternalist until we first understand what the argument is for distribution in the first place. So if it turns out the reason the state has an obligation, or we have an obligation to redistribute to others, is because, for example, the state or we have an obligation to respect the rights of other people, then it might not be the case that distributing cash to people is the best way of meeting our obligation to respect their rights. Tim Scanlon has the famous example of even if a person's most preferred use of cash is to build a monument for their god, it doesn't follow that I'm obligated to give you resources so you can build a monument to your God, right? It's a further question whether I'm obligated to do that. If the grounds of my obligation are different, if they're not about your meeting your preferences or satisfying your preferences, but the reason for distribution is, let's say, to protect your rights, then it can't be that the charge of paternalism applies, in the sense that the charge of paternalism assumes that state provision is already justified, and then asks, what form should it take? Like, we have an argument for redistribution, now we're going to ask, should we restrict it in some way so that it's not just cash? But on a lot of theories of justice, it may be that that's the questions aren't separable in the way the critic needs them to be, the paternalist critic needs them to be. The form of distribution and the justification for distribution aren't two separate questions, right? Once you figure out the argument that justifies distribution, you're actually committed to a certain form of distribution. And if that's the case, which I think, and I will argue in my positive case, that is the case, then the paternalism justification the paternalism objection doesn't go through. The paternalist objection assumes, right, that we have an obligation to distribution, and now we're asking, what form should it take? But if that's not a separable question, right, then the paternalism charge doesn't take hold. So, anyway, that's the claim. Anyway, that's the negative. So now let me try to build a positive case for in-kind distribution. And I'm more sure about one part of this case than I am about the other. So start with the one I'm more sure about, and then think about the other one with you. So the first part of the case for in-kind distribution builds on this idea that certain theories about justification already are committed, right, for some reason, maybe because of some reason of justice. So I want to claim that in-kind distribution plays an important role in securing full inclusion, right, of society's members. The central task of government, on my view, isn't to maximize a particular welfare outcome, but to enable all of society's members to play the social game as equals. That's hard to do. Like, how do we live in society as each other's equals? Well, we're not equals, clearly, when some have to grovel while others can order them about with impunity. We're not equals when some have the opportunity to occupy important social positions or influence the rules of the game because of things like their social class, their religion, their gender, or their race. So let me give you three examples where I think cash is inadequate for allowing people to play the social game as equals, and where in-kind goods have a very special role to play. So my first case is thinking about disability and disability accommodation. So here's one way we could address obstacles that people face because of having certain kinds of disabilities. We could give people with disabilities cash. And with that cash, they could maybe work at home or work less than they would have to otherwise. They could hire people to carry them over steps so they could get into buildings. They could hire people to shop for them in narrow lanes, which won't fit wheelchairs, so that other people, they can therefore have people help with their shopping. This might mitigate some disadvantages that the disabled face, and it might save money over in-kind accommodation, but it would do little to address the social segregation and stigma that have led to the disabled being relegated to an outsider caste. The main reason to distribute resources to the disabled in kind, accessible ramps, wider bathrooms and aisles in public places, is to break down the hierarchical segregation of social groups. In the case of people with disabilities, I'm arguing cash can't do this by itself. So you need to have this in-kind accommodation to bring people in to play the social game as equals. That's case one. Case two, consider the gender division of labor, under which women still disproportionately perform parenting and household labor. In trying to redress this inequality, which affects women's employment opportunities, we could pay mothers for the extra labor that they currently perform for free. Now, maybe that would be an improvement over the status quo, but it would do little to change the default baseline division of labor. In fact, it would probably further entrench it. Women would be better off and have fairer opportunities with respect to men if we could shift to a situation in which parents had equal likelihood of working inside or outside the home, regardless of their gender. One way to encourage that would be to give parents the in-kind good of access to publicly provided daycare. So that's my second example. My third example, return to the example of education. So I said that economists frequently argue that of course you provide education in kind because there's a externality argument for doing that, which is there's spillover effects for not having an educated population. And so that's the reason we provide education as a free and as a right to all. But is that really a good argument for free education? Is that really a good justification? Well, there's likely a threshold below which the lack of education has worrying third-party effects. The public good argument doesn't actually justify universal education. I should say Milton Friedman thought it did. He has a chapter in Capitalism and Freedom. But I actually don't think there's an argument for universal education here. I think there's an argument for majority education, but not universal education. So what kind of argument could there be for providing universal basic public education free to all? Well, one such argument is that education is necessary if everybody's to have a fair opportunity to compete for valued jobs and social roles. Another argument might look to the role that education plays in giving people the tools they need to exercise their rights and to demand them. In both arguments, it's the causal properties of education that matter, causal properties that cash doesn't have. So that's my third argument. Now, I think the type of argument I've given could be extended to other goods provided in kind by government, including access to healthcare and perhaps to employment. While certainly not all the goods governments distribute in kind to their members can be justified this way, as enabling everybody to play the social game as equals, I believe a lot of them can. So now I'm going to turn to my second argument for in-kind good provision, which is a little less, well, you'll see what you think about it. It's not quite there yet. But here's the second rationale. So, and it's actually a form of the externalities argument I looked at earlier, that there are social costs of supplying all goods through cash that are not accounted for by the transacting parties. So let me try to explain this. This takes me back to my early 2010 book. One of the great virtues of a market economy is that it allows people to sort and differentiate based on their preferences over work and leisure. You and I don't have to agree on what's important in order to cooperate with one another for mutual advantage. This is not only a great thing because we can make trades that make us both better off, but it leads to the development of personal autonomy, right? I don't have to ask your permission, right, about how I'm going to live in order to trade with you. It's a great thing about the market, the differentiation that it allows. But at the same time, a society, and particularly a democratic society, requires certain experiences and surely certain institutions where everyone is on an equal footing and everyone is treated in the same way. Standing in line to vote, for instance, standing in line at the DMV with respect to the rule of law, or serving on a jury. Some theorists have called these situations points of forced solidarity. And among other things, they serve as a check on the tendency of the rich to drift off into their own world and to exit from the circumstances of the ordinary person. Checking this tendency is especially important for political decision making, where political leaders will often exempt themselves from the policies they impose on others, sending their kids to private schools, for example, while cutting public school spending. But this point about solidarity, I think, has implications beyond just political leaders. With the abolition of the military draft, which, by the way, it's a fascinating story in which Milton Friedman played a major role in abolishing the U.S. draft, something that's not really understood and appreciated as much as it should be. But with the abolition of the draft, there are very few remaining places in contemporary American society where people from different social classes spend time together on an equal footing. The absence of such circumstances makes it hard for anyone to imagine that we're all in this together, that we're all in the same boat. Now, I went back, I got really into this thing about being on the same boat, and I went back and I looked at kind of an iconic image, right, which was John F. Kennedy's PT boat during World War II. So here's John F. Kennedy, the son of one of the richest people probably in the world, but certainly in the United States at that time. And on his boat were the son of a carpenter, the son of a farmer, right? People from very, very different walks of life. Okay, it was all men, and mostly white men, but it was still a mixing, right, of social groups together. The absence of those kinds of circumstances make it really hard to imagine, like, we're all in this together, and to have pro-social attitudes. And by contrast, think of Canada's single-tier healthcare system, where if you're a bank executive and a bank customer, you're in the same waiting room. Like, how many times will that happen? Right, in the United States, in a country where people can, again, differentiate and select. This lack of interaction on a footing of equality leads to social division, misunderstanding, and ignorance. And indeed, it arguably undercuts the epistemic benefits of living in a democratic society. So here's Tawney criticizing the system of private schools in England. He says, "It's at once an educational monstrosity and a grave national misfortune. It's educationally vicious, since to mix with companions from homes of different types is an important part of the education of the young. It's socially disastrous, for it does more than any other cause except capitalism itself, to perpetuate the division of the nation into classes of which one is almost unintelligible to the other." end quote of Tawney. So the common experience argument, the solidarity argument, can be strengthened by observing another effect of having these points where you force people to be in the same boat or in the same, treated the same, have the same goods. And that further argument is that this also protects the interests in some situations of the most vulnerable. So a study that Joe Wolf cited, something he wrote years ago by John Adams, looked at the effects of the introduction of seat belts in automobiles. So I can remember this, goes back a while, but when seat belts were first introduced, only the driver of the car needed to wear a seat belt. None of the passengers needed to wear a seat belt. And to the surprise of policymakers, right, this actually led to an increase in the number of automobile-related deaths. Why? Because drivers now felt like, okay, I'm safe, I can take more risks, and those risks were imposed on other people. So sometimes the best way to protect the most vulnerable is to put everybody in the same situation. You can think about on a boat, why is it that the captain is supposed to be the, you know, last one, right, remaining on the boat? It's so that the captain, right, internalizes, right, the costs of the most vulnerable. And there's some, I have some evidence from school funding in California that actually, I think, speaks to this. So in California, we have a state equality mandate for spending, but there are ways that schools have gotten around it. And one way schools have gotten around this is that each school has formed a 501(c) connected to the school, so you can direct money to your own kid's school. And there's some suggestion that this has led to less support for overall schooling, because why should I pay for your kids now? I can direct it to my kids, and I have less incentive. I can, you know, again, like the policymaker who can relieve themselves of costs that they're imposing on others. So it could be that sometimes the way to protect the interests of the most vulnerable is to put people in the same camp. Okay, I have more. I have an argument finding on a race and social solidarity, but I'm going to, for the purposes of time, skip that. This is, as I say, the part I'm not completely sure of. So let me just sum up. So I've so far said in-kind goods, benefits can sometimes be efficient. They don't have to be paternalist, but can arise from our collective obligations of justice to each other. And I presented an argument for equality in certain in-kind goods in terms of social inclusion and social solidarity, also noting the related obligation to protect the most vulnerable. So I now want to quickly just go through three objections to this argument. First, somebody might say, is this really a good egalitarian strategy? Wouldn't distributing cash more equally also create a common culture and a background for solidarity? In fact, a critic might say, look, once you have unequal wealth, it's just unstoppable, right? And particularly at the level that we have of inequality today, it'll always translate into unequal political power, unequal educational advantage, unequal opportunities that fission society. They might suggest that even if the state provides good public education, those who are richer will just spend a lot more of their own resources on their own kids' education than the state is willing to provide, and that'll undermine this idea of playing the social game as equals. Large disparities of income and wealth will inevitably make it impossible for those who have more to shape the rules of the game to their advantage. So I think that's a serious objection, pretty empirical. I mean, we have to look at what we can learn a lot from looking at how different societies have handled these issues of the overflow of income and wealth into other areas. But even if this is this argument gets a thumb on the scale, it's still going to be the case, right, that some of the examples I mentioned, like disability accommodation, childcare, issues about social integration, are not going to be addressed simply by providing cash alone. So it might be that cash is going to be a piece, and more equal distribution of cash is going to be a piece of this argument. After all, cash is also important for social inclusion. You can't be socially included if you're, you can't play the social game as an equal if you are like living in dire poverty. But what I've been arguing is, no, even beyond that, there's a special role that in-kind goods play. Okay, second objection. Yeah, maybe you're right. There's this nice philosophical, theoretical argument that you could show that in-kind distribution isn't necessarily paternalist, but after all, most of it has been given paternalistic rationales. Food stamps have long been justified, right, by the idea that poor people are just incompetent in making various kinds of decisions, and they'll spend their money on alcohol and not on food, so we have to restrict their ability. Even some taxes which fall disproportionately on the poor have a paternalistic rationale, so I should say it's not just in-kind aid, it's also cash. So if you think about the cigarette tax, it's hard to argue that externalities alone are part of why we tax cigarettes so highly. We know that poor people are much more likely to smoke than rich people. I think there's a, when we don't tax like skydiving at high rates, so I think there's a paternalism behind this. So even if it's theoretically possible to give a non-paternalistic justification, isn't there paternalism all over the place? So I agree that there is a lot of paternalism and that there are a lot of in-kind goods that I think only can be justified on a paternalistic basis. They don't really lend themselves to the in playing the social game as equals argument I was giving. But I do want to note that cash transfers to the poor have also been given in a humiliating and insulting way in the United States. And so it's not just about the form, it's also about the way we do this. We gave to GIs the in-kind good of education in the GI Bill, but that wasn't done in a way that was humiliating or and maybe you will say it's objectionably paternalist, but it certainly wasn't given in a way that had the stigma of the GIs not being in a position to make good choices. So that's my second. It's yes, there's paternalism. Many forms of in-kind goods are going to be objectionably paternalist, but not all and not automatically. And cash can also be given in a way that is stigmatizing and treats people as if they're incompetent. Third, isn't this still, even if it's not paternalist, an objectionable interference with individual freedom of choice? And I don't know if I want to invoke my inner Stalinist here, but sorry, maybe that wasn't funny. But, you know, there is a way in which, you know, the argument does have some implications that private schooling should really be off the table, that the advantages, you know, this kind of argument is really pushing at the common schooling as a necessary condition for full inclusion and social solidarity. So it has that I will bite that bullet, but you might worry about that bullet and how far am I going to go in biting that bullet. So I think there's room for reasonable disagreement about the scope of choice. I certainly think having a wide scope of choice is important. And what the best, Canada provides healthcare benefits in kind and doesn't allow private healthcare providers to compete, at least in some provinces. Britain allows people to buy private insurance. I mean, we can learn a lot from an array of different options, but a critic might be really worried and push the point even further and say, well, you're providing these things to people like healthcare and education, but aren't we also obligated to force people to take these things up? Donald Trump argued, not only should we give people food stamps, we should actually choose the food for them and give them boxes of canned food that, I don't know, maybe people should stay and watch and see if they eat it. So is that an implication of your argument? Can people really play the game as equals if they don't take up these benefits? So I think that's an important question for me. I think in a lot of cases, it's not going to damage people's ability to play the game, or at least have the opportunity to play the game as social equals if they don't take up the good, if they don't buy health insurance, if they don't use the health insurance that they're obligated to buy. But I do think there probably are cases where people not taking up a good makes it the case that the social game itself unravels. So one interesting case to think about is about voting. If not very many people vote, there is a sense in which the legitimacy of the whole system, right, is in question. So our ability to live together and play, the democratic game as equals is undermined. So I'm going to anyway leave this. I'll leave that question for another time. So, in conclusion, I've tried to argue that the efficiency and paternalism objections can be met, and that there are positive reasons, there's a positive role for in-kind goods, some of which has to do with the nature of those goods, so the nature of education, the nature of certain kinds of opportunity. I've also said there's social ends, protecting the vulnerable, solidarity, that we can't achieve through uncoordinated individual actions. And I've argued that this is not a paternalist claim. It's really a claim that goes back to the architects of the social welfare state, which saw the social welfare state not as a provider of handouts or as a wise paternalistic intervener. Instead, they saw the goods the welfare state would provide, free schooling, free health services, public housing, and job training. They saw in that the deliverance of a society in which citizens could relate to one another as free and equal members, citizens who could play the social game as each other's equals. In-kind goods play an enabling role in this that money by itself can't play. Or, to conclude, as Tawney put it much more eloquently than I, here's a quote, "What is repulsive is not that one man should earn more than others, for where a community of environment and a common education and habit of life have bred a common tradition of respect and consideration, these details of the counting house are forgotten or ignored. It is that some classes should be excluded from the heritage of civilization which others enjoy, and that the fact of human fellowship, which is ultimate and profound, should be obscured by economic contrasts, which are trivial and superficial. What is important is not that all men should receive the same pecuniary income. It is that the surplus resources of society should be so husbanded and applied that it is a matter of minor significance whether they receive it or not. Thank you.